This episode is brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768.
This episode is also brought to you by Oddmo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade, awesome pizza plus craft beer, wine, and cider delivered. Call them today at 503-263-8444.
Welcome to Now Hear This Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of Now Hear This Canby. I am your host, James Walton. Let's read the news. Clackamas County received 1,000 doses of the Moderna-produced COVID-19 vaccine this week, which it says will be administered to frontline healthcare workers and first responders. Now Hear This Canby has learned that the vaccine will be made available to personnel with the Canby Police Department and Canby Fire District on Monday for those who choose to receive it. Canby Fire Chief Jim Davis and Police Chief Brett Smith will be among those to take the vaccine, Davis said, and plan to receive their shots at the same time if they can make the schedules work. The Moderna vaccine was the second to be approved for emergency distribution in Oregon after immunization developed by Pfizer. Top scientists and public health officials have declared both vaccines safe and effective, including a four-state scientific review panel that includes Oregon, California, Washington, and Nevada. Both vaccines require two shots for full efficacy, about 3 weeks apart. The main advantage possessed by the Moderna treatment is that it does not require ultra-cold storage. The Pfizer vaccine must be kept at temperatures between minus 112 and minus 76 degrees Fahrenheit, which is not available in all areas. As of Wednesday, more than 31,300 Oregonians had received their first dose of one or the other vaccination, with frontline healthcare workers as well as vulnerable residents of long-term care facilities being the first in line. Those numbers include more than 2,800 Clackamas Countyans. An estimated 70% of the population must be immunized to reach the baseline of herd immunity, according to the public health officials. State leaders have acknowledged they face an uphill battle in encouraging Oregonians to embrace the vaccine, which is the first messenger RNA or mRNA vaccine to be approved for use, and it was the fastest vaccination ever to be developed for a new virus. How well do you COVID-19? Clackamas County has launched a new digital public health engagement effort recently, which officials say is aimed at building community support and adoption of COVID-19 safe practices. The effort includes a short quiz designed to assess how closely residents and businesses are following safe COVID-19 practices. Along with most of the state, Clackamas County remains in the extreme risk category for community spread of the novel coronavirus, according to the latest metrics for reopening businesses and organizations. Quiz participants will be scored based on their responses to 5 short questions centered on sanitation, physical distancing, business operations, and other practices. The first 2,000 quiz participants will receive a free Clackamas Strong face mask, and all participants will be entered into a raffle to win gift cards to local businesses. To take the county's COVID-19 quiz, you can visit clackamasstrong.org. Santa came early for several Clackamas County residents this year, and he carried a badge. He came in the form of Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, who followed through with his department's modified annual tradition of Secret Santa, stopping unsuspecting residents and handing them, instead of the ticket they might be expecting, $100 cash. The money comes from members of the public who generously donated more than $10,000 to the sheriff's office specifically for this purpose, Roberts said in a Facebook post. Our generous donors want nothing more than to know that they may have brought some joy to a stranger and created a positive interaction with law enforcement at the same time, the post said. Throughout Clackamas County Sheriff's Office employees will be looking for that special person to offer these gifts to, the Sheriff's Office said. It could be the person down on their luck, a good Samaritan, or just for whom the deputy wanted to brighten their day. Sheriff Roberts kicked the event off earlier this week, visiting several different offices of the CCSO, including Community Corrections, a Safe Place Family Justice Center, and the Patrol Division. Next, he hit the road to surprise a few lucky souls. There were a few who were shocked or surprised, the sheriff's office said. One person was left speechless. There were even a few tears. Well, we saw the most were smiles. Well, at least they were smiling under their mask. Sheriff Roberts and his entourage made sure to be conscious of COVID-19 precautions, officials said. For photos, you can find the story on our website at canbefirst.com. An Oregon City man was arrested after rolling his vehicle in an alleged drunken driving crash on South Sawtell Road near Molalla Tuesday afternoon. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office said in a Facebook post this week that Carson James Renner, 37, was visibly intoxicated and uninjured from the crash. Renner reportedly rolled his vehicle in the collision, but a passerby helped right it before police arrived on the scene. A photo from the crime scene shows what appears to be several empty cans of White Claw hard seltzer lying on the shoulder. Police said Renner thought his blood alcohol concentration was 0.07, which would be below the legal level for blood alcohol content. Tests showed that it was actually 0.26, more than three times the legal limit. He was arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants. Another of what deputies described as notable DUIIs occurred later that night when a patrol sergeant reportedly watched Arturo Hernandez Galvan, 31, of Gresham, drive his Mitsubishi Eclipse off Highway 26 in Boring. The vehicle traveled across the gravel shoulder and into the grass field before returning to the highway. The sergeant conducted a traffic stop and contacted Hernandez, who provided a driver's license that turned out to be suspended for felony DUII. Hernandez wasn't done making bad decisions, though, the sheriff's office said on Facebook. Hernandez drove off abruptly in an attempt to elude. A short pursuit ensued, which ended when Hernandez missed a curve and high-centered his vehicle on a rock. He was taken into custody without further incident. Hernandez's blood alcohol content was 0.17, and he was booked at the Clackamas County Jail for felony driving while suspended, attempt to elude, and DUII. Clackamas River Drive will remain closed through at least the first week of January, the county has announced, to protect travelers from an unstable slope due to a landslide that occurred between Highway 213 and Springwater Road during the heavy rains before Christmas. Clackamas River Drive is located at the northwest area of the county near Clackamas and follows the course of, you guessed it, the Clackamas River. The county closed Clackamas River Drive on December 20th, and road crews removed landslide debris from the road this week. However, county officials said that due to the unstable slope, there is risk of additional slides in the area. The county says that road crews and other experts, including engineers and geologists, are assessing the area and expect to determine appropriate next steps in early January. With more rain on the way and the unstable hillside, we are going to keep the road closed for now to make sure travelers are safe, County Transportation Maintenance Manager Shane Abbott explained in a press release. County officials ask all drivers and residents to stay away from the closed portion of Clackamas River Drive.
Stay connected to what matters most this holiday season with unlimited high-speed internet from DirectLink. While the holidays may look different for many of us this year, you can always count on DirectLink's reliable network to keep your video calls, Snapchat, stories, and photos crystal clear. DirectLink is thankful for all of their amazing members this holiday season and is proud to be your local internet, video, and voice provider for over 116 years. For more information, visit directlink.coop. And from all of us here at Now Hear This Candy and our friends at DirectLink, stay safe, stay healthy, stay connected, and have a very happy holiday season.
Well, it is finally over. Say what you will about the year 2020, but you can't say it wasn't memorable. On today's episode, we will be revisiting some of our favorite moments and interviews from a remarkable year in covering news in the community we love. For more year-in-review coverage, find our stories 2020 and 20 Photos and 50 Stories from 2020 You May Have Missed on our website, canbefirst.com.
We have Bill Cole, who lives up in Clackamas. He was not able to make it this year because of his health. He's been, you know, the previous 24 years he's been there. But Bill is a unique in and of himself. He was there the day that, and on the beach at Iwo Jima. He came home, was honored to be discharged in 1945. And then when the Korean War broke out, he re-enlisted and went back. And ended up at the Chosin Reservoir too. So survived both of those events, which were, you know, that's a part of Marine Corps history. I mean, it's it's almost a fable.
Speaking of ice boxes, right?
Exactly. From the sandbox to the ice box. But you know, the memorial over there, if you I know you covered it and you take some pictures. You know, the sand that is scattered on the memorial rock is from Iwo Jima.
So explain that, because that's such a beautiful part of the ceremony with the sand and the sprinkling.
Well, we have several veterans who have returned to the island of Iwo Jima over the years.
That famous black sand.
That famous black sand,
Infamous, I guess.
And they do allow you to bring back a controlled amount of the sand. So and we have had enough of it returned to us to where we can present some of that sand to survivors and veterans. And so by scattering a piece of that island on that memorial, it makes a connection between the two. So it becomes a part of the island.
And it's open to not just veterans of Iwo Jima or of World War II?
Well, no, World War II and the Iwo Jima veterans and their survivors. And then, of course, dignitaries as well. So we like to recognize, you know, Mayor Brian Hodson and some of the other dignitaries that come and participate in the program to also take part in that part of it. So,
That's really cool. You had a great quote, I thought, Martin, again, with the pictures and posting them on Facebook, just why you do it, why you keep the ceremony going, and why you work so hard to honor that generation.
Well, I want to honor them while they're here, because the sacrifices they made, you know, as a veteran myself and several others, you know, our sacrifice pales in comparison to theirs.
Yeah.
guys, one thing that I've always loved and really appreciated and admired about your guys' work here at the Canby Center is how that holistic approach that you take to the person and or to the family, that it's not just, well, here's some food, good luck. You know what I mean? Like, you do the life classes and the parenting classes, and there's clothes, and I'm sure that's still going on as well. But there's you do the job interview and professional development services and all kinds of stuff here. When this hit, I know you said you suspended something like a dozen of the 16 programs, and it just became, no, right now the critical need is food. Can you explain that decision-making process? And was that difficult?
On about March 3rd, we sat down as a team and we developed a response to COVID-19, a mitigation plan.
Early.
And it was pretty early for us.
Five cases at that point.
Yep. And I have to give kudos to one of our staff members, Kathleen, who really was bringing it to my attention because she was on the front end of it with our Reading Mentors program.
Okay.
And she was beginning to be concerned for our elderly volunteers, primarily elderly in the Reading Mentors program, who were coming in and interacting with kids in the school system.
Wow.
Schools hadn't made a decision yet.
Right.
It would be another few days, I think maybe a week, before the schools would close. But we sat down and we set up a plan. We developed five stages of closure for the Canby Center. And what amazed me is that we needed that plan, number one, and we needed it quicker than I would have ever guessed.
Yeah.
When we sat down and developed the plan, I thought to myself, if this gets implemented, it's going to be over 3 or 4 months.
Right.
And I thought, the reality is it probably won't get fully implemented.
Yeah.
Well, we moved through stage one in the first week to stage two to stage three to stage four within really a matter of about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And that's where we sit now, is at stage four, which is primarily focus on food.
Yeah, sorry. It's so funny looking back, because like looking back, that's just like so obvious, you know, because we've gotten to this point. But at that time, it would have been crazy to imagine schools closed, theaters closed, all these businesses closed, economic recession, record high unemployment. I mean, no one was thinking any of that on March 3rd.
No, exactly. That's exactly right. So, you know. But what I loved about that process is it prepared us to take the next steps when we needed to take them. Mm. So stage one for us, for example, was what everybody was doing in a business. If you had one open at the time, you were buying Lysol wipes and you were wiping and sanitizing and doing more cleaning than you would normally do.
Right.
But we moved really quickly from just extra cleaning to thinking about what needs to close, which programs, and in what order.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I have described it that, you know, 90% of our energy now is really going toward our food programming.
Yeah.
So when somebody comes to us and needs food, we're getting them food.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was the sort of philosophical or strategic reason that even in your plan, that was stage four, that was, if we got to that point, we're going to transition into being this primarily?
Well, if you're familiar with like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, when you think of the most essential needs that people have, it is for things like food and shelter, you know, some of the basics of just what does it take to survive. Some of the programming that we typically
can lead into thinking about higher needs.
Yes,
you can't think about education or whatever if hungry.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in a way, when you think of sort of triaging, coming back to the essentials, those are the essentials. And so we began to move through things at the top of the list that we could move off or change. So, for example, we believe it's really important that people have a connection with God in some way that's meaningful for them. So we make that available to people in a variety of our programs. And in the food pantry now, we've pivoted where our devotional that usually would be spoken as we do a food pantry is now done in writing beforehand. So pastors in the community, staff and volunteers are taking time to write those out, type them up, and then they get translated into English, from English into Spanish, and they go out to each person who comes to us. But we do that because there's value in each of those layers of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Even at the higher end, in this kind of a time. But we have to find ways to do that that doesn't put people at risk.
Hmm.
Yeah, you mentioned the parents. I kind of laughed a little bit because I've heard from several parents that have been helping with the homeschooling or distance learning these past couple months that have just been like, I will never criticize my teachers, my kids' teachers, ever again.
Yeah, it's been a challenge for a lot of parents. The older kids can be held more responsible for independent learning, but having them cooped up and going a little stir crazy, I feel for so many of our parents.
Yeah. Well, can you talk a little more specifically and for folks that follow the podcast and our website, a lot of it will be familiar, but before we really dive into graduation, which we'll talk maybe a little bit more about, what are some of the other ways that you and the team at CHS have really sought to try and make this graduation as, or this end of the term, I should say, special for seniors this year?
Yeah, well, you know, we took a look at what we usually do, and we've tried to replicate just about every event that we do for the seniors. So Everything from athletic awards nights to senior recognition and awards. We're still doing these things, albeit in a virtual setting. And then as we rolled into graduation, we really took a strong look at what a lot of other school districts were doing and tried to steal some of the best ideas and incorporate them into our own.
Right.
And you're familiar with how we did the filming for graduation. Of course, we will be releasing that next Friday. The gates, the virtual gates will open at 5:15 and then we'll have the full ceremony at 6:00. And it'll be about as close to replicating our real graduation as possible. And I think one of the nice things is that the kids will have that video record for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a personal and professional experience, which our traditional graduation, and which we all enjoy, not as an intimate of an affair that this has become.
Chief, you described your reaction, and it seemed to be very, very much the same as I think anyone who saw it, just shocked and outraged at what you saw. Is that true?
That is true, yes. The loss of life in that manner, and the loss of life in any particular situation is something to be really concerned about. But in this particular case, the video is pretty dramatic, and, you know, it's there's a lot yet to be reviewed, and it's now being reviewed at a criminal level, and I'm trusting that the justice system will work. But I think what we see in television is pretty shocking, and I think it's disappointing just because of the negative impact it leaves in the law enforcement profession as a whole. And so from that perspective, it's really disappointing. And again, just to know that someone lost their life in that way is one that we shouldn't tolerate as far as the conduct of police officers.
Yeah. And you talked a lot about, it was real interesting in your statement, you talked a lot about this idea and even going back to Sir Robert Peel and his take back in the 19th century, but this sort of social contract kind of view of police force, and that at least you see it and many others in law enforcement see it as very much, you know, a sort of partnership with the community and based on a sense of mutual trust and respect. And in this case, obviously, where you see folks that are, you know, took an oath to uphold the law, committing an act of, a horrible act of murder, that was what really struck you, obviously, outside of even just the tragic loss of life in any sense.
Well, I think, yes. And I think my response, it was more specific to the question you'd ask about who's responsible for the safety of uniformed officers who may be facing these kind of demonstrations and who are risking themselves. And at this time, during great tension and divisiveness. And so I think a little bit as I was trying to explore your question and answer it, was really, you know, when it comes to safety, you know, initially I had answered that I ultimately, as all of our officers, have a responsibility to one another from a safety perspective. But it gets much bigger than that. And I think my point was is that while we have great partnerships and relationships with the police, and part of that community policing philosophy has to do with reduction of crime and the prevention of crime and livability, quality of life issues, it goes farther than that. It's working and building on relationships in such a way that during good times, but then in the bad times, that we have each other's back, that we're working together for the same common goal and purposes. So that we have a community that's safe. We have a community that has a quality of life that they can expect. And I think when you talk about safety during these types of events, when there is risk for personal injury for everybody who's involved, we would hope that the relationships during those good times build and remain intact during the bad times.
It's been kind of tough. We have a lot of our accounts, the on-premise accounts, which are beer, taverns, bars, restaurants, that have been hit pretty hard.
Absolutely.
We've had to make a lot of changes to our business just in how we go to market and adjust to that. And what's happened too, as you can imagine, is a lot of that volume shifted to grocery stores and Costco's and that. So the whole kind of delivery mix that we do has changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
And we've had also, we have people in the stores, we have people in warehouses working in fairly, somewhat close proximity, and we have drivers that are interacting with receiving clerks. And so we've had to change a lot of how they actually interact in those venues. Like the merchandisers in particular are out in the store and in the back rooms stocking product. It's one of the more challenging jobs in the company. And then they're interacting with customers at the account. And so a lot of different process change. And we've spent a lot of time trying to care for our employees, make sure that they have, the best information and the best equipment that they need to stay safe, remain safe and keep those around them safe as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I really want to dig into a lot more of that, but let's start by, if people are like, wait, what even is Columbia? I think most people are aware at this point, but obviously you guys are one of the largest beverage distributors in the country, have a really long history here in our state of Oregon, the largest, I believe, here on the West Coast. Lindsay or Andy, can you tell us just maybe a little bit more, give us a little bit of a brief overview of Columbia, your employees, maybe a little bit about what your company is all about.
We are about an 87-year-old company now that was started in Portland, Oregon. And we have grown to 14 branches throughout Oregon, Washington, and Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
We now have around 2,700 employees. And we are consolidating three of our warehouses that are in Portland to one that is going into your great city of Canby.
I heard something about that, I think.
Maybe you've even seen it too, that mall-sized structure.
Yes, yeah.
That we are building out there.
Yeah.
That we did build. It is almost done. So we distribute beer, wine, spirits, non-alcoholic products, health beverages, including kombucha, water, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We play a big part in the communities where we live and play. And one of our primary goals is to give back, which hopefully the town of Canby has seen a bit so far prior to us even entering there. I know we've really got to know you through some of the great things that you do there in Canby, including fireworks displays and street parties and some of the philanthropic efforts that you have there that we've been able to tie into.
Almost anyone who has an athlete, it's kind of part of your identity. And there's a lot of, mental things that go along with having it pulled away. You see a lot of kids who have like an ACL tear or a major injury that keeps them out for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It really messes with their psyche around the game. And it really just hurts, not just physically, but also mentally, because, again, it's part of who you are. It's all the clothing you wear, the people you hang out with. Everything to do with that is all to do with athletics. So when that gets taken away, it really messes with what you, with who you are. And so our athletes specifically over the past 4 months really have had what I would say a lot of times their identity stripped from them. And they're looking for every opportunity to get out, get better, and do what they'd love. There's a reason why kids love going to work out. It releases those endorphins in your body that makes you feel good.
Right.
So being around people, working out together, pushing each other, that's what everyone wants to do.
Right, right. And I mean, that's one thing. And in the previous episode, when folks are listening to this, we had Tucker Hunter, former Canby High grad. I didn't know if you knew him, but very top level.
Here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but he talked a little bit about the COVID stuff and how it's affected him, and you mentioned the social aspect. I mean, in some ways, or in a lot of ways, you can't recreate a lot of the stuff that you get from athletics. I know a lot of non-athletes may think, oh, you can still work out, you can still run, you can do exercise or whatever, but the what you get even physically from high-level competition can't be recreated on your own often, and then obviously the social aspects that you mention.
You know, it's challenging because pretty much in every sport I've been involved in, when it comes down to your practices or anything like that, you want to recreate competition.
Yeah.
Because that's what really makes everyone better. They're competing against themselves, their own numbers, but also competing against others around them that are pushing them to make them better. Those are the kind of things that you do. I mean, when I was coaching soccer, it was basically every single thing we did, we were challenged to make a game out of it. It didn't matter whether it was push-ups, ladders, anything. It had to have a game or a competition. There had to be a goal in mind. And so when now all of a sudden we are running by ourselves doing that, it's tougher to create a goal.
Right.
I will give our coaches a huge hand on this because they've been really creative. They've done a lot of virtual meetings, a lot of different programs have. Mm-hmm. They've found ways to continue to connect with them, continue to send them workouts. I think some of them have continued to try to find ways to compete even virtually with camps and everything like that. It's just extra challenging. And also it's, you know, kids have to use a little more of their imagination where, it's a little different than in the past.
Yeah, absolutely.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was gonna go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
And then they'd use this tool right here and apply gentle pressure on it, and the meat would come out through that tube and fill the casing.
Yeah, so you're literally telling us how the sausage is made.
Absolutely, yeah. And then once they had that fresh sausage made, then they'd put it out in the smokehouse and cure it.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's just a simple, you know, it's the concept of leverage.
It's like a... obviously not, but for the listeners, sort of a coffee can looking.
It's thing. About the same size as a, you know, a large coffee can, only a little bit taller with a spout coming out the bottom.
On it, yeah.
And
just shoot that meat.
And right then also, I've been a big thing because they were German. A very big thing that they did was sauerkraut making. They made a lot of sauerkraut.
Yeah.
And you'll see here in front of us a very large stone crock.
Uh-huh.
Right there is a really large sauerkraut cutter, as is this. You take the sauerkraut, put it in the box, run it over here, and it'd cut out thin slices of cabbage. Mm. And then you would pack it in the crocks with the tamper, add nothing but salt.
Mm-hmm.
Usually ratio of that. I happen to make a lot of sauerkraut myself, so it's 5 pounds of cabbage and 3 tablespoons of salt. So.
Oh, that's all. Wow.
Yeah. And then you pack it down and...
No water or anything.
It's no.
The water that it has. Okay.
Yeah, just the water that's in the cabbage itself.
Wow. And how long would they leave it for?
Sauerkraut is usually made best in the fall. At that time, the cabbage has a lot more water in it. And you don't need to add any supplemental water. So make it in November. And depending upon the outside ambient temperature, mm-hmm. you know, it would probably be ready in a couple months.
Mm.
If you kept it inside in a heated environment, maybe as little as a month.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't, it's a fine line. You don't want to get it too warm. You don't want to get it too cold because then it stops fermenting.
Gotcha. Whiskey.
Golden Rule whiskey. That's an interesting story. I don't know the history of distilling Golden Rule whiskey, but the story that I have been always told is that when Dr. Kyle was getting ready to move out west, he had a young son named Willie who was looking forward to the trip. And Dr. Kyle said, Willie, you're going out west. You're going to Oregon with us.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Willie died before they left for the trip, very shortly before, as a matter of fact. And Dr. Kyle put him in a lead-lined casket and filled it full of Golden Rule whiskey and drove him on the back end of a wagon all the way from Bethel, Missouri to out west.
Wow. Why?
Promised his son he'd take him to Oregon. So he was... Above all else, he was a man of his word.
Well, Cooper, can you tell us a little bit about your career up to this point and how you got into filmmaking?
Yeah, so I whitewater kayak, and that's kind of how I got into making videos, is I would make GoPro videos for that, and I ended up getting a sponsor when I was 17, and so started making more more videos, and then decided I wanted to do narrative stuff. I had always wanted to write and found screenplays were kind of really clicked with me, and so I took a break from school and kind of shifted focus, and then my first like opportunity in the business was I actually got an internship on Portlandia four or five years ago now.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it was very cool. It was a great opportunity. I actually got into surfing through kayaking, and then I ended up doing that, and then I did a short film one weekend, and got a job on this Netflix show, Everything Sucks, which was my first paying gig in the industry. So
awesome. Well, Everything Sucks. What is that about? Sounds funny.
Yeah, it only ran for one season, unfortunately, but it was a Netflix show about kids in boring Oregon in the 90s. So.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can kind of guess what that would be like, being a 90s kid myself, not growing up in Oregon, but growing up in a small town. I can foresee some of the fun antics of that.
Yeah, it's kind of a teen comedy, you know, so it was cool. So... I started working in the industry pretty regularly while I was finishing school, and wanted to make my own stuff. And so I started at first just making a really short, simple little movie with a couple of friends. And then over the years, I've kind of evolved. And as my network has grown in the industry, I've been able to bring people in and you know, I Macy's Parade was kind of, it's the first movie I think my, got my skills kind of coalesced into something I'm pretty proud of. So
yeah, you should be,
you know, I'm excited for it to come out and for people to see it. And, you know, I want to keep making movies and, it's been a blast.
Yeah.
Over the last
You've had like the coolest life so far. Like, I'm so jealous. I just was a sponsored whitewater kayaker and that's how I learned how to do film. And then I got jobs in it. I'm sure it's that easy. You know. It's always that easy to get into the industry, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird industry. There's no direct route. It's not like you apply and then you get a job, you know. It's all gig-based. So
right.
I still work in the industry in between making my own movies, doing freelance gigs mostly.
Yeah.
Mostly on movies and TV, but in the last year or so, I started doing more commercial work. I was a producer at an ad agency for a few months and then do some commercials here and there just to, you know, pay the bills or whatever. But, yeah, it's a cool lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to have found my way.
Firefighters in general been dealing with that. I mean, I can't imagine, like, just as a regular citizen, you know, trying to keep up with the evacuations and everything that's been, you know, impacting all of us. But then to, on top of that, be doing this incredibly critical, incredibly stressful job. How have you guys been making it through this past week and a half?
Yeah, so, again, these are those unprecedented times. And I think, you know, at baseline, our families are used to stress and used to chaos, so they probably have a little bit of a leg up in terms of being able to be adaptable, but this is something we've never seen, and our support system that we have out there has been absolutely incredible, whether that's, you know, spouses, friends, partners, families, whatever. They have been overwhelmingly supportive. Of course, early on when the firefight was really intense and changing very dynamically during the wind event, and we were working through evacuations. Stressful times for our firefighters just to know that their families were safe, and I think that's one of those pieces early on you want to check off your list of things to do, and that's get your family in a safe location. And, you know, when you're out firefighting, you don't necessarily have that time. So I have spoken with a couple firefighters who mentioned the stress of that, you know. And
sure.
Putting that decision solely on their family to make, with just intermittent text conversations or brief phone calls within those first 48 to 72 hours where things were just so dynamic and so rapidly changing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just want to ask you a couple more questions. I know a lot of people have, and as I mentioned to start this interview, you know, so many are so appreciative of the work that our firefighters are doing in different counties and all across our area. I guess I just want to ask you, how are you guys holding up?
Yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, I mentioned it earlier that this is an event that occurred in your backyard, and so you're working on behalf of your friends and families and neighbors, but you end up connecting with the community as a whole. And,
yeah.
I can't tell you how important it is for our firefighters to feel that, and when they're out there on the line and people are honking their horns and waving and saying hi and thank you, I mean, it really just means the world to our crews.
Mm.
And that's honestly what keeps you going during those times, because early on when resources were light, they were working really, really long hours.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just, you know, moving from call to call. It was moving from call to call and working really, really hard and then moving on to the next. So the community, the outpouring of support is incredible. But really, we need to focus now on those who have been impacted by this and make sure that the resources are in place for that. And Clackamas County has done a fantastic job providing those resources. Again, their website is Clackamas.us, and it covers everything from mental health to the resources people would need as they move into the recovery phase if they were impacted by a loss of a structure. So some really great resources, but really it is that time for us to collectively come together as a community and buoy those people up and make sure they've got the resources and the help they need. Our firefighters have dealt with this, but really I think we'd ask that the focus remains on those who are impacted. So with that said, I think there are two great ways for people to get involved to donate in terms of resources, and that's financial, if it's an option. Of course, the American Red Cross is a staple in the community and has the resources in place to accept those donations and support those who have been impacted. And then the Clackamas Emergency Services is a local managed by a board out of Clackamas County that typically was put to, it was first started to put money in the hands of first responders to help those community members who were in need. But they've since branched out to help those who have been impacted by tragedy. And so certainly this is one of those times, and they're a great resource as well.
And of course the fire station was just out the back door about a half a block away. So when I joined the department, it was I'd made a deal with my boss that I'd just make sure and have things done in case we had a fire or something. And I'd just stop what I was doing and run out the back door and half a block, and I'd be on the back of the engine and away we'd go. So it worked out real well. And then of course within a year, I had started my own business. And of course, it was easy to do, to come to the fire station, because I just locked the door and take off.
Hang a sign on the door.
In those days, you could do that and get away with it. Now, if you were to lock your business up and say you went to the fire, you'd probably have customers that weren't real happy. But back then, they realized that it was mostly businessmen and people in town that were the firefighters, and so they knew that if that whistle went off, that there would be probably a lot of businesses that were locked up because they were going to the alarm. So that's just how it worked.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because that was definitely something I wanted to ask you about. That's an aspect that's obviously, unfortunately, a little before my time, but something that really fascinates me about that era and many years before as well, where fire districts, even in urban cities, were mostly volunteer run, and it would literally be, the hardware store would have a little piece of paper on the door that says, closed to go fight a fire back in, a couple hours or whatever, and people just understood that. I've even heard stories about, they would, in much earlier days, they would leave the doors unlocked, and people would just, if they needed to get something, they would just leave money on the counter, and there was that kind of trustworthiness, but that's got to be interesting to see how that's evolved over time with you being the volunteer chief. How long have you held that role?
Oh, it's been, our last chief was Bob Herman. And then came, I think it was prior to Chief Davis coming in. So I think he's been your 5 years.
Yeah.
Probably 7 years now.
Okay.
Chief Coons made me the volunteer chief, and then Chief Davis made me a division chief of the volunteers. So it's probably been 6-7 years or better.
But you've seen that kind of evolution. I'm interested to hear a little bit more about. Obviously,
that goes on all day.
It is exciting. There's a real excitement in the air on Election Day. I don't know if that's because all of our workers are knowing that there's the end in sight, no more ballots coming in. But the work we do is very important. We're the gatekeepers of democracy, and our workers all know the importance of all of it. And for me, it's just been really exciting that we've had such high returns so early. It's much easier to have all the volume at the beginning instead of at the end. The two of the days right after ballots went out, we got 34,000 and 36,000 on two different days, and that's totally unheard of. So it just puts excitement into the atmosphere that so many voters are voting. It's really important to do that.
Yeah, I'll just echo that, the same thing. I mean, it's exciting. We're also pretty tired. I mean, this doesn't feel like a normal election day. It feels like we've had about 16 straight election days. We've been doing this for 2.5 weeks at a pretty high volume. And so it's really exciting to see those turnout numbers grow. It feels like a historic election, so we're excited to see that participation. And with the national conversations around voting in a pandemic and with vote by mail, we are excited to be able to showcase our procedures and our policies and our laws so that voters around the country can see that vote by mail works. It is a secure way to get every eligible voter a ballot and try to give them every opportunity to vote that ballot. And so that keeps us going and kind of provides that extra adrenaline boost while we finish counting every vote we have.
One of the things I've heard from a couple of our temp workers who work at the tables opening the ballots, you know, in past years, we've never had this much volume at the beginning. And so there's more of a keeping up each day with what the tables are preparing for tally and having them run through the scanning machines. And yesterday, I think, was the first day that the tables weren't covered with boxes of ballots waiting to be opened and scanned. It's been a little hard for some of them that are such perfectionists. They felt like they weren't working hard enough, but they've never had such a high reserve of ballots to be processed. So yesterday, I think they felt a little better because you couldn't see any boxes on any of the tables.
Oh my word. You had just gotten some donated ones because their PPE was impossible to find.
Right.
And so, right. You know, that was like a new thing. People are making these now. And now, of course, you know,
now the new wardrobe.
Now the
new fashion statement. Yeah. Well, gosh, since March, we're continuing to do home delivered meals.
Yeah.
That's grown by about 60%.
Okay.
Since the
and
beginning.
That's stayed consistent.
That has stayed consistent.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, every week we get calls, some drop off and some come on, but it stayed pretty consistent. We're serving, again, about 170 individuals. Mm. And it translates into about 4,000 meals a month.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets them 7 days a week. So we've had to add a Meals on Wheels route. We've reorganized the kitchen so that our drivers don't enter the building.
Okay.
They just pull up out front. We wheel all of the coolers with the hot and cold meals in them out the front door,
uh-huh.
And they just pull up and we load for them so that they're able to, you know, we're minimizing contact in the building.
Previously, they would come in and load themselves?
Yes.
Okay.
Under normal circumstances, they come in through a side door in the dining room,
okay.
And grab them and go out. So,
yeah.
And we wouldn't be able to maintain this because it's a massive tripping hazard. So everybody just knows they've got to sort of clear the front area when they're coming through.
Have you brought on more drivers?
We had to add one route, which meant more drivers.
Okay.
And there's always turnover on drivers. So
yeah.
We've been really, really lucky that, again, the community support has stayed consistent.
Yeah.
One challenge that we're having is that any unaccompanied volunteer has to be background checked.
Okay.
And that sits with the state of Oregon and they're backlogged.
Sure.
So when we do need to get a Meals on Wheels driver cleared, what normally took 3 weeks is now taking 10 to 12 weeks.
Yeah.
So, but so far it's okay. I mean,
yeah.
The drivers we have who are cleared, we have some who are willing to step up and take a second route.
Yeah. I remember actually that was part of our original conversation as well, that you were getting flooded with a lot of people wanting to know
right.
how they could help and
That's
wanting
right.
to volunteer, and you saying that unfortunately that was not as helpful as you wish it could be because
That's
of
right.
the need to background check and the
That's
backlog
right.
That especially back then was probably impossible when
yeah.
when the state was first going to telework. So
Yeah.
Well, we weren't even trying to do them back then.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah.
Now we're having to, now that this is turning into, you know, our new normal for at least through the winter.
Yeah. Holiday season is a wonderful time of year, but it can also be stressful, and 2020 is certainly no exception. If you're feeling a little overloaded, let the Wild Hair Saloon take family meal planning off your plate. Whether the current status allows in-person dining, the masters of takeout have you covered. Ask about their family meal deal carryout special, a double portion of chicken fettuccine alfredo, a huge Caesar salad, big enough to share, but if you don't, we won't blame you. Garlic toast and two kids meals with cookies for only $25. Plus, their mouth-watering prime rib dinners are available Friday and Saturday nights. Open Monday through Friday, 11 to 8 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, 3 to 8. Visit thewildhairsaloon.net or call to order 503-651-4273.
Now Hear This, Cambie is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Franke. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Cambie by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This, Cambie is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Cambie's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.